York City. It's the Gary Knoll Show.
This will be an everlasting love. This will be the one I've waited for. This will be the first time anyone has loved me.
And now, your host, so Gary Knoll.
He found me in time, and I'm so glad.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. It's always a pleasure to be able to spend this hour with you, always with the idea of empowering people. We have so many negative things going on in the world, it's important to also know that we have positive solutions, something we can feel good about. As you'll see in this hour, I'm going to offer some insights and solutions to the immigration crisis. I'm going to play a clip that you have not been aware of so that it adds a different dimension and a deeper context to the plight of the immigrants and why we have politicized the argument on both sides, and it's simply wrong what we're doing. We should have a more humane, a more spiritual approach, and I'll share that. I have a guest, Alan Phillips, the most important attorney in the United States on vaccine issues. And he is under attack. The federal government and the entire vaccine industry is on a witch hunt to bring him down. And we're going to talk with him to see what we can do to help him. We also have, time permitting, I'm going to talk about how the war industry corrupts the U.S. Congress. That'll be a commentary from Common Dreams and one from Medea Benjamin and Nicholas Davies. Also, The Experiment in Freedom is Failing from John Whitehead, and why that's important. So we'll get through as much of this as possible, and we're going to begin always with the latest on health and healing. I want to start, however, by a new study that just came out today from the CDC, and it talks about the country folk. Now, these people are being hit harder by the U.S. obesity epidemic than city dwellers. That's according to two new government studies. In fact, it is so bad that nearly 40% of rural American men and 50% of all rural women are now statistically obese. And that means that they're more than 40% body mass index. And that also applies to their children as well. And further, rates of severe obesity, that means morbid obesity, that means when you really have a chance of dying because you're so overweight, grew much faster in rural areas than metropolitan areas during the past decade and a half. And, quote, if you look at the trends in men, severe obesity more than tripled in rural areas. In women, severe obesity more than doubled. So here is a question for you. I have my own ideas because, after all, I'm out there all the time. I'm counseling people. I'm listening to what people have to say. I'm going to their homes. I'm going into their neighborhoods. I don't stay in an ivory tower at some university and theorize about the world from a safe existential position. No, I go out and meet people everywhere, as I will be doing this summer, in a van going to 15 cities, talking with people. Between the cities, I'm going through rural America. I'll be stopping and talking to them as well. I want you to give me your feedback as to why you believe we have more morbidly obese and obese men and women in rural America than ever before in our history. These are not ignorant people. These are people who are obese for a reason. It's not by accident. They have access to the internet, television. We have a worldwide communication web. We have information flow 24/7. So it's not as if something has been obscured from them, filtered from them, isolated from them. They are as integrated into this world as anyone else, but they are suffering at a far higher rate. Why? And what do you propose will be a solution? As calls come in throughout our program on this issue, I'll take them. Our callback number is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. And if you live outside of the calling area, which is Canada and the United States and Mexico, you can email us at prnstudio@gmail.com. That's prnstudio@gmail.com. From the University of Minnesota, nearly all adolescents have eating, activity, or weight-related issues. That's a new study from the Minnesota University School of Public Health. And when you're looking at, they're not saying a few percent or 10%, they're saying all young people are struggling with eating, activity, and weight problems. Quote, only 2% of females and 7% of males surveyed never had an eating, activity, or weight-related problem. Wow. 98% have that problem. And this was published in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. And then as they got older, it didn't get any better. 78% of females in a survey had at least one eating, activity, or weight-related problem. 82% had similar markers even 15 years later. What this means in lay language is we have an entire pandemic of health-related problems, emotional problems, in adolescence, following into teenage years, and it's not changing. The capacity to adapt to it so that we can still fit in, we can still function, we can still go to work, changes, but it still means that we are unhappy campers and a nation of dysfunctionals. Why? I have no problem sharing my ideas. I spend a lot of time alone in contemplation. I think through things. I try to see them from different perspectives. Occam and Razor, a theory that whatever the simplest explanation is generally the most accurate, is correct. What stops us from being accurate and honest is political correctness and conditioned response, so we don't look stupid or we don't say something that we might feel by other measures is insensitive. What do you believe is the reason that we are completely emotionally dysfunctional society from children up? What's the core? It can't be a thousand things. It's one thing that manifests in a thousand different forms of dysfunction. What do you believe it is? I'd like to hear your thoughts. So you have a chance to call in on this as well. This is a talkback hour today. 888-874-4888. And if we don't have any calls, I'll share my thoughts. But I'd rather hear yours. And also for those of you who thought, based upon the old science and the old medicine, that what we have at birth is what we have throughout life and nothing changes outside of our skin and some mitosis issues in the cells and the intestines, but your heart is your heart, your eyes, your brain, it doesn't change. That's not true. In fact, the Learning and Memory Center, an institute at MIT, shows our brains are famously flexible, or for want of a better description, plastic, because neurons can do new things by forging new and stronger connections with other neurons. But if some connections strengthen, neuroscientists have reasoned neurons must compensate, at least they become overwhelmed with input. So in a new study published in Science magazine, researchers at the Picower Institute for Learning and Memory at MIT demonstrate for the first time how this balance is struck when one connection called the synapse strengthens, immediately neighboring synapses is weakened based upon the action of a crucial protein called ARC. That's very exciting to know this. Remember, in your brain, it's a very complex, ever-changing system of synapses. And this should be likened to how a massive school of fish can suddenly change direction in mass, so long as the lead fish turns and every other fish obeys the simple rule of following the fish right in front of it. Now, in the larger universal context, this means, well, let's call it collective behaviors of complex systems always have simple rules. When one synapsis goes up with 50 micrometers, there is a decrease in the strength of the other synapses using a well-defined molecular mechanism by 50%. So what this is telling us, in simple terms, provides an explanation of how synoptic strengthening and weakening combine in neurons to produce this plastic movement. And there are multiple manipulations. Now, it may seem simple, but the experiments are very complex. So how does this manifest? Why should we care about this? Because it is my opinion, having done 4 clinical studies on the brain with individuals, not mice in a laboratory, but rather individuals who had advanced neurological and neuron destruction, Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, ALS, myasthenia gravis, Parkinson's, dementia, that I thought, well, the universe never teaches us by half-truths. So when they teach us one full truth, then by the concept of quantum thought, we must be able to apply all truths fully. Now, what do I mean by this? Because this is my own construction to allow me to understand this. Let's just say that homeopathy, we'll use it as an example. If you were to burn your hand, the skin would become inflamed. It would ooze. You would have little bubbling or lymphocytes. The pus would, you know, suddenly be seen. It would swell. So what would be the homeopathic treatment? Well, the homeopathic treatment would more often not be poison ivy. Why? Because based upon the laws of similars, that which causes a condition in a healthy person can reverse that condition by using its opposite. So, if you were to touch poison ivy, then your skin would inflame, you would get these bubbles, you would have swelling. So that's the remedy, but it's in a diluted fashion, so diluted that it's the energy exchange. Even homeopaths haven't got this right. Almost every homeopath I speak to says it's the molecular structure substantially reduced, and I say, okay, I have a different opinion. I believe it has nothing to do with the dilution, whether it's 5,000 or 30,000 dilution. I believe that it's the energy that is the messenger. Remember, life cannot exist without messages that are coordinated. And therefore, messages must be communicated. And the communication system, this is where your synopsis come in, and the message communicated in any way that the body can receive it. If someone likes you, you feel it. They don't even have to touch you. You sense it. You can be excited. Your whole biochemistry senses it. If you're laughing, you don't have to have anyone touch you. You don't have to have anything proven. You're thinking something is funny. You're hearing that something's funny. And you're relating to that. And you're laughing. Same way with something sad. Same way if you're in a movie theater and you see, let's say, something violent on screen. You're not being violated. It's just an illusion. But you're reacting as if it is. That's energy. That's a transference of energy. So everything in life must be based upon a transference of energy. The key is what is coded into the message is what's important, not the atomic structure by which it is conveyed. So we've made the mistake of looking in the wrong place. We keep looking at the molecule and trying to reduce it down to a mathematical equation that can be measurable, instead of looking at the energy that was locked into the molecule and released. So the molecule becomes secondary in nature. Hence, if homeopathy works, that means that every single thing in life has to have the same capacity, because nature does not teach by half-truths. So a tree has to be able to communicate, and now we have learned it does. Trees communicate with each other in vibrations. They communicate through the root system. So you see, we're even now, yesterday I read a study, I didn't present it yet to you, but it's about dogs will look at your face and know exactly what you're feeling based upon your structure of how you're moving your face and your eyes. It'll respond to it. That's an energy exchange. The dog doesn't have to know exactly what's wrong to know something's wrong. The dog doesn't have to know why you're happy to know you're happy. You see, we've never studied energy, except like Enrico Fermi and splitting the atom and what we can do at the atomic level, or a gene in the genome to manipulate it, to add something to it. But we've never created life. No one's ever created energy in history. All we can do is take existing energy and manipulate its form. So understanding this is how I create my protocols. And that's why I can't just put my protocols out there and expect everyone to use them. They're individualized. And that's why we had people reverse Alzheimer's, reverse Parkinson's, and reverse myasthenia gravis, and reverse dementia in that study. That should have gotten a lot of news. I even took these people before scientific conferences with 7,000 scientists. Not a single person asked me how to do it. Not a person. When I reversed AIDS, and 8 out of 8 people, there were actually 12, but 8 did 6 days a week, 4 hours a day for 16 months, and I reversed all AIDS, did a press conference, invited everyone, the governor of New York, David Patterson, you'll see him in the pictures there, the big banner, AIDS is not a death sentence. A group of scientific specialists were there to speak with 100 people. There were 8 of the people I work with, but there were 100 from around the United States. Not a word in the media. No scientific journal picked it up. That should have been the most important conference in the history of AIDS. And yet, instead of being respected and people coming in and looking at what was done, we were attacked because we weren't doing the antiretroviral drugs. So you see, we're not ready for the truth yet. You've heard me say that you'll never see a revolution in America, and you won't. Not in our lifetimes, because we're not in enough pain. Now, I want you to think deeply what I mean by that and why no one will revolt. You'll have little tiny, 100, 200 people. It's meaningless. Doesn't change anything. You could have 10,000 people. Wouldn't change anything. But you won't have any quantum change. Even when disasters that are predicted occur, you'll have massive amounts of people dislocated or destroyed, and it still won't cause change. When the economy collapses, which it will, or at least for 65% of the people, the economy collapsing will put them into dire poverty. For the rest, they don't care. They are rich enough that nothing in the economy is going to impact them, but there will be no changing. When people are this morbidly obese, when there's this much disease, when there's this much unhappiness, there will be no change. We're not in enough pain. And we won't ever get the right cures for what ails us, because we have left out of the equation the one thing that is essential for all success: energy exchange. That's what I teach at my retreats. I don't actually teach it. I share it. I just never describe it, because quite frankly, if you can't understand it, then what is the purpose? Experience something, you don't need it explained. Life was never meant to be figured out. Life was meant to be lived without the complication of artificial constructs, deleting, filtering, altering us from that exchange. It's that simple. Anyhow, from a university in the Netherlands comes a study about cacao, that's chocolate, Tea, like green tea, can slash your heart disease risk by dying by 40%. That's terrific. A long-term consumption of epicatechin, epi, catechin, catechin, that's a compound found in green tea, oolong tea, white tea, black tea, plus apples, plus chocolate, can significantly boost your heart health and reduce the risk of heart-related death. This is a big study. They collected data over 25 years and found that you could lower your risk of dying of a heart attack by 25% if you ate apples, had chocolate, and green tea. That's good news. And also, because I'm looking at the clock here, I want to make sure we get everything that we need in, from the University of Gothenburg, that's in Sweden, the first time this study's ever been done, it showed that probiotics, that's the good bacteria, either as a supplement or as a food, is useful for the human skeleton. That means that many older women who are taking their probiotics are going to have stronger bones, less bone loss, less osteoporosis. That's good news. That's important. Well, we are in our 22nd minute of our program. We're going to take a break and come back. I'm Gary Noll. Please stay with us. I'm still waiting. Interesting, I have such a huge audience of such educated people. I thought you would have some ideas about why we have more obese people now and morbidly obese people and their children in rural America than ever before in our history. Why? I have an answer, but I want to hear yours because we have some good answers, some people in this audience. Also, why are so many children, infants, teenagers, and adults suffering from so many problems? I want to hear your solutions. I'll hold on. Hopefully people will call. I'm going to go to an audio clip in a moment. Before I do, I just want to mention that I think the best thing possible that could have happened at this particular moment is for the deep state to finally emerge from the swamp by overreacting against Trump. Now, Trump's not a likable guy. He's not a smart guy. He's not a good president. But that's not the issue. If Hillary Clinton been elected or Bernie Sanders elected or Jill Stein elected, you would never have found out how corrupt our justice system is, how corrupt our Justice Department, National Security Agency, the CIA, the FBI, and now it's all coming out. And they can't stop it from coming out. And who says this? This is in a report from the Justice Department's own Inspector General. He's showing how people at the top people from Comey on down, were all involved in a conspiracy to whitewash Hillary Clinton's multiple illegal acts and then to try to get the president who was elected out of office by saying he was put in there by Russian meddling and hijacking inside of the Democratic National Committee, which is simply not true. So the deep state. So here's what I've done. Over the last 2 months, I have reached out to some of the most important minds in the world, and I have invited them to spend time with me and give me their deepest insights into the deep state, from the Patriot Act to the National Defense Authorization Act to the police censoring of free speech to criminalizing poverty to militarization of the police to reintroducing debtors' prisons to accepting the shredding of our constitutional rights, accepting asset forfeitures, control over our central banks, the Federal Reserve, controlling the currencies, bailing out Wall Street but never Main Street, controlling and influencing the engine of globalization and the new economic colonialism, the dominion of the media. Yeah. Everything involving the deep state. Who are they? Give us their names, the companies they work for. How did they get there? 4 hours, four experts, top people in the field. And I put it all together into a brand new CD set, 4 hour CD set, entitled Deep State Emerges from the Swamp. This is brand new. I did a previous deep state, but this is all new based upon everything that's happening now that we did not know before because it never showed its hand. It had plausible deniability. And this is on sale at half price. I'm introducing it at half the price. Give a call to this number and become informed. Listen to these things. Listen to this 4 hours. You haven't heard these people talk on this topic anywhere else. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065 for the new, brand new, just finished, Deep State Emerges from the Swamp. And we can actually, strange and bizarre as it is, because we can thank him for nothing else, but on this, because he could not be controlled, because they feared him and feared he would not play along with them, and they knew Clinton would, they overreacted. In their overreaction, we got the truth. It's emerged. So we took it and ran with it, and we took it deep. These are deep conversations, powerful insights. This is an epiphany for most people. You'll finally know who these people are, how they got their power, how they've held it, how they've kept it secret. The deep state emerges from the swamp. 4 hours, brand new. Call 877-627-5065. I don't even know how much it is. I think it's under $50. It's normally should be around $100. 877-627-5065. Now, we have no callers. Anything else, we would be packed with calls on solutions and understanding the problems. So I'm going to play a very important audio clip about how the United States outsourced its border security to Mexico and how that created a problem. I will explain, because some of it's when the man is allowing some Spanish speaking, it's not all in English. I'll explain what they're saying afterwards. But what they're all saying is that the police in these sanctuaries along the way in Mexico and the federal agents, Mexican federal agents, that we, the United States and Barack Obama, gave money to, they stole all their money. In some cases, they stole everything they had and left them literally naked, not even shoes. They took their food. These are the Mexican police and the Mexican government officials, utterly, totally, rankly corrupt at every level, and how these people would be raped by gangs. And so what they put in motion was not to help. Barack Obama did nothing to help the immigrants get to the United States. He empowered the Mexican government to militarize itself. And so the people who had to get from Honduras and Nicaragua and El Salvador, where there's massive killings and brutality and rapes, they had to get through Mexico. And that became one of the most arduous, dangerous journeys imaginable. The media never covered it. The president enabled it. The Mexican government, as they do with everything they do, they were part of it. Hear this story now.
There on the bridge, there's a normal border crossing with migration people stamping passports. But you go down these wobbly stairs, you notice that right under the bridge, these guys are trafficking people across the border, technically illegally.
You can't tell that there's been an immigration crackdown here, but there has, and it was the U.S. that paid for it.
These guys are doing it under the noses of immigration officials who clearly don't care that much.
You only start to feel this crackdown when you start moving north, where you run into a new network of military infrastructure and checkpoints meant to stop migrants. But this crackdown was never meant to keep Central Americans out of Mexico. It was meant to keep them out of Texas. In 2014, the United States sent an influx of money to Mexico, helping them militarize and fortify their southern border region. To understand why, you have to look at this chart. The red line represents the number of Mexican migrants apprehended while they're crossing into the United States, and the green line is for non-Mexican migrants. Look at 2014. That's when the number of non-Mexican migrants outnumbered Mexican migrants for the very first time. What pushed this number up were the migrants coming from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. And these people fleeing from Central America aren't just looking for jobs. They're running away.
So there's a war going on in Central America right now. It's actually not just one war, it's a ton of micro-wars.
Unbelievable violence.
Nearly one homicide an hour.
Three of the five highest homicide countries in the world. Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador.
Carved up the city into warring factions.
Una doña que tenía un negocio, le quitaron así, mira, cuatro dedos.
Residents of these towns are at major risk of dying, and so people are fleeing.
While riding with the U.S. Border Patrol on the Texas border, I watched them apprehend a 22-year-old and his son as they just made the 3-week journey up through Mexico from Honduras.
Vengo amenazado de muerte. Porque mi hijo y yo corremos peligro en mi país. No puedo regresar a mi país porque vengo amenazado de muerte. Sí.
These refugees walk into Mexico mostly hoping to make it to the U.S.
Y la verdad yo necesito que me apoyen aquí, por eso uno viene hasta acá para que le ayude.
Many come here to this town called Tapachula, just north of the border, where they can look for a migrant shelter to lie low and get support. And at this vulnerable point in their journey, many don't want to show their face on camera.
And there were these threats just constantly came to me. And then one day I just said, the hell with this, I'm gone. Mm-hmm. I burned my little rancho and I took off at 2 o'clock in the morning.
The exodus out of Central America came to a head in 2014, when the U.S. saw a huge spike in the number of Central American kids and teens arriving to the border without a parent.
It is a huge humanitarian crisis on the border right now.
52,000 unaccompanied children have been caught at the U.S. border with Mexico, double the number recorded last year.
Children from Honduras traveling into Guatemala, then Mexico, crossing the Rio Grande, and just now arriving in Texas.
As soon as it became clear that this year's migration to the border was different than in past years, I directed FEMA to coordinate our response at the border.
Obama declared an urgent humanitarian situation at the border. He discussed it with Mexican President Peña Nieto. Peña Nieto walked away from that meeting and immediately implemented a policy called el Programa Frontera Sur, the Southern Border Program.
And earlier this week, Mexico announced a series of steps that they're going to take on their southern border to help stem the tide.
For Peña Nieto, the plan had two main objectives.
Uno, proteger y salvaguardar los derechos humanos de los migrantes que ingresan y transitan por México. Y dos, incrementar el desarrollo y la seguridad de la región.
In short, the plan was supposed to make life better and safer for both migrants and those living in the border region, which includes Mexico's most impoverished state, Chiapas. This migrant protection plan for the southern border had been in the works for years, but it was rushed into implementation, apparently in response to American pressure. Many of the long-term plans that were meant to give migrants legal support and protection fell away, Instead, the implementation focused almost entirely on enforcement and security.
What's easiest to do, I think, is enforcement, because you already have the infrastructure set up. Like, it's harder to create jobs, right, than it is to hire more immigration agents and detain people.
Mexico's quick solution to this was to militarize, to start raiding buses, to start putting up checkpoints, to start cracking down on Central Americans who were coming into their country. A perfect symbolic representation of this are these huge multi-agency complexes that they built in order to house the immigration officials alongside the Army and the Marines and the Federal Police.
Mexico fortified its southern border region. And to help in the effort, the U.S. sent an influx of money and equipment, using resources from an existing security partnership it had with Mexico dating back to 2007. This partnership was originally created to combat drug trafficking and organized crime. The money was used here for things like inspection equipment, canine teams, observation towers, training for immigration enforcement officials, communication networks to support enforcement activities, and gear to collect biometric data like fingerprints and photos of detained migrants. In short, the U.S. helped militarize the southern border region of Mexico.
The U.S. got what it was looking for.
In part because of strong efforts by Mexico, including at its southern border, we've seen those numbers reduced back to much more manageable levels.
Apprehensions on the Mexican side went up, and people arriving to Texas or other parts of the U.S. border went down.
But this was all temporary. The number jumped back up in 2016. So the crackdown isn't actually stopping people from getting to the United States, but it is making their journey much more dangerous.
Behind me is the train that Central Americans take to get from here in southern Mexico up to the border with the United States. If it were 2014, this area would be completely packed with migrants.
Migration officials targeted this train. They started conducting extensive raids, and the train companies hired guards, increasing the speeds of the trains and installing concrete posts and walls to make it harder for people to jump aboard. And now, gangs are a constant threat to the few travelers that remain. Here are the main routes that migrants took to get to the United States. They mainly followed the train routes. These paths were well supported with migrant shelters and clinics, and most importantly, large groups of other migrants, making it less likely that people will be robbed or assaulted. Migrants often don't know where their next meal will come from or where they're going to sleep each night. They depend on this network of usually church-sponsored shelters as they move north. The 2014 crackdown targeted these routes, looking for migrants in popular places like shelters and train stops. So migrants moving north have shifted into unfamiliar, unsupported routes that multiply the dangers that they are already subject to on this journey.
Como es monte, entonces le pueden salir ladrones, o es peligroso.
Pushing these refugees away from well-trodden routes and into the shadows has made them more vulnerable to assaults by criminals and gangs in this region.
A él le pegaron con la pistola en la cabeza, lo golpearon y jaló a la niña. A mí me jaló la niña, ella jaló a la niña y le dije, suéltela, la está lastimando, y la niña llorando. La está lastimando y si no la suelta voy a gritar, le dije.
During this time, the U.S. Border Patrol started putting out public service announcements about how dangerous the journey through Mexico had become. This, in spite of the fact that U.S. policy contributed to those risks.
Que hoy sea más fácil que nuestros hijos consigan papeles en el norte es falso. Que los estamos haciendo presa fácil de coyotes, la bestia y el desierto es cierto.
All of the shelter directors I talked to have noticed an uptick in crimes against migrants since this crackdown. A study by dozens of migration organizations in Mexico found that of the 5,824 investigations into crimes against migrants, less than 1% had led to any sort of sentence. And many crimes go unreported altogether. There's not a lot of trust in the Mexican justice system for migrants.
y le decía uno al otro, matémonos, boles, y los llevamos para adentro. Ahí se ponen que pensar uno, tocó sacar lo que traíamos.
Porque nosotros venimos huyendo de este problema de nuestro país y lo venimos a encontrar acá con el problema, entonces seguimos en lo mismo.
Most migrants are now left on their own, navigating this remote region where both gangs and corruption-prone police are looking for ways to profit off vulnerable migrants.
Aprovecha su cargo de ser guardián o ser vigilante para detener a ellos y sobre todo amenazarlos, ¿verdad? Es decir, si tú no me das nada, yo te deporto.
Fíjense, lo supe yo que por cada migrante que agarran les dan 200 pesos. Es un negocio lo que tienen ellos, ¿ya?
Hay un problema grande ahí de la corrupción y la impunidad, y los migrantes todo eso prefieren seguir invisibles.
But perhaps the most egregious offense of the Mexican state in this crackdown comes down to what they didn't do for these people entering their country. When a Mexican immigration official detains a migrant, that officer is required to inform them that they have the right to ask for refugee status or asylum if they're fleeing for their lives. Everyone I talked to said that isn't happening.
There were 40,000 children who entered into Mexico in 2016, and these children aren't looking for jobs, they're not smuggling drugs, they're looking for protection. Of the 40,000 that came here, only 1% applied for asylum. That's a dangerously low number for a country that has said that it protects asylum seekers.
Migrants who feel a threat to their lives in their own country have to fill out an application and submit it to an agency that has the power to grant asylum or refugee status in Mexico. This allows them to avoid being deported, to stay in the country. But this agency that's in charge of processing these applications only had 15 caseworkers dedicated to interviewing these applicants. And while applications are on pace to be 12 times what they were in 2013, this group's budget only grew 5% during the crackdown. The year the Southern Border Program was implemented.
That just gives you a little insight into what type of horror faces every one of these. And 40,000 unaccompanied children were sent up. Now imagine what it means when you're so poor and you are unable to have your child live safely in the country because young girls are susceptible to being kidnapped by gangs and forced into prostitution or killed, raped and killed. The Gang 13, MS-13, recently on Long Island, took a young girl from high school. They multiple raped her, beat her with baseball bats, cut out her heart, and cut off her head. And this is the type of behavior that Nancy Pelosi says, well, they're still human. No, that's not acting human. And unfortunately, when ISIS decapitated people and burned that Jordanian pilot alive in a cage and all the other atrocious acts they did, MS-13 can do the very same thing, but somehow they're still considered acceptable at the human level. By what metrics of spiritual evaluation is that? So pull back for a moment. Stop thinking of yourself as an open border or closed border, of no sanctuary or sanctuary, of giving amnesty or no amnesty, and just be realistic. If it was so good in the countries that they lived in, they would stay there. They're not coming here because of jobs, because the only jobs most of these undocumented immigrants can get is nothing more than indentured labor working in the fields of California, Texas, and some other locations in Florida out at Immokalee, where they're paid $4 an hour, they're exposed to pesticides. It's a horrific situation. Now, this was created by Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. It was passed into law, and there was first introduced in 1996, and 1992, it was being talked about. In 1996, it was also recodified as a separate law under Obama. So we've had two presidencies who've gone up in their national address to Congress and the American people, in their State of Union address, have railed against illegal immigrants, but not once have they implemented a program to allow an expeditious way of getting people into the country. It is ridiculous to tell people, you have nothing now, you're dirt poor, you have no advantages and no real advocates, but now we want you to get into a line and wait 20 years and then pay us a heavy tax. This is just foolish thought. We should have a way that we can properly screen people to make sure that they're not members of gangs, they're not involved in organized crime, they're not trafficking in young girls that many of them do, and that we can expedite this. I don't believe in amnesty. I believe we should give forgiveness and not charge them a nickel. How can you take money from someone that doesn't have it to begin with? And the only work they're getting is exploitive work. That's just a double negative. We have to apply some principles of real morality here, and we're not. Everything has been politicized. I want you to hear this clip because before someone becomes self-righteous and demeaning and demanding that these people do something, that why don't you try living in their shoes for a week in El Salvador and then making that journey that they make and then see what it feels like when you end up at a border, either at the legal entry where it's not a crime or illegally across there, and see how does your perception of this event change. More on this on an upcoming program. Let's go now to my guest who is standing by. Oh, by the way, I was just sent this note that we're only charging $49.99 for our four-hour Deep State Emerges from the Swamp set. Now, let's go over and say hello to the lawyer who is down in Asheville, North Carolina, Alan Phillips. And Alan is one of the only attorneys in America today exclusively practicing vaccine exemption and waiver law and individual and legal rights on vaccination policies. He advises families and individuals and attorneys and legislators across the country on vaccine policies and health rights and exemptions. And Alan's website is vaccinerights.com. Nice to have you with us today, Alan.
Pleasure and honor to be here with you, Gary. I'm particularly appreciative because I'm dealing with a most unusual situation now.
Tell us about how you, the leading advocate for freedom of choice and defending those parents who do not want to have mandatory vaccines, how you now are the one they're trying to destroy.
Well, Gary, I'm sure you're the last person I would ever have to introduce the concept of when you speak out against corruption, corruption attacks you. But I am a victim of an attack right now that I really didn't expect, caught me off guard. This is coming from my own state bar. Every state has a state bar that licenses the attorneys in that particular state. And I have proof that they have literally made up facts and law that they are using to build a case against me, presumably with a predetermined goal of taking my license. I assume, although I don't have proof on this point, that it's because they don't like what I do for a living. North Carolina is one of, if not the top vaccine manufacturing state. It's been referred to as Vaccine Central because the vaccine manufacturing plants here in North Carolina have won awards. And so it's a heavy pharmaceutical state, and I suppose I've been lucky over the years of flying under the radar in terms of people at the state bar knowing what I do, but someone filed a couple of false complaints, which normally get dismissed very quickly, but in this case, they have decided to pursue it. And the current situation is particularly bizarre, Gary, because when I realized, and it actually didn't gel for me right away, but when I realized, and there were two different complaints after the first one, when I realized that they had not only made up facts, but they invented law, and that got clear to me when I consulted a legal expert on the issue in question, and the legal expert says, not only did you not do anything wrong here, Alan, but if the facts that the bar says were true, it still wouldn't be a problem. Which, and I'm giving you a short story because I know our time is limited, but what it means is the bar made up facts and law. So, Gary, I did the one thing that nobody ever does. I filed a complaint with the North Carolina bar against the North Carolina bar attorneys who were involved in making up facts and law. That's a pretty egregious ethical violation. And perhaps predictably, they are suppressing that complaint. Of course, the bar can't investigate itself, so this would have to go to some sort of independent outside committee to avoid this obvious conflict of interest. And Gary, I'm not the only one who has filed complaints. There are some organizations around the country who, based on information that's out there on the internet, so I didn't, you know, just say, hey, go file a complaint for me. They found their own information, and they have filed some complaints. And all of these complaints are being suppressed in a blatant denial of the obvious conflict of interest. So my response to that is to create, and I have just created, a nonprofit corporation called Bar Watch Incorporated. And it has its own website, just launched the website yesterday, as a matter of fact. I've been working on it for a few weeks. It's barwatchonline.org, barwatchonline.org. And I present the story. But there's even a couple other pieces to this, Gary. I did a little bit of my own investigating. And I have found attorneys who have been disbarred in North Carolina claiming that the bar attorneys who investigated them made up facts. And I know this is a possibility because I've seen them do it with me. But it appears now that not only have they done this with me, that I'm not an isolated victim or instance. And I have also found a couple of what I'm just going to call insiders for their own protection because they prefer not to be identified, but people who have watched the bar do this as well. So I have multiple sources confirming, validating not only my experience, but confirming my suspicion that there's probably a years-long pattern of behavior here. And I'm sure, although I don't have proof of this, that in my case, it's because they don't like what I do for a living. This is a lot more, Gary, though, than just a personal attack on me, because as you noted right up front here, I'm the only attorney in the country who does what I do. And the law with vaccines is different from everything else. So it's not just as simple of if they take my license, somebody else can step in and do the same thing. First of all, if they take me down, nobody's going to want to touch the area of law. And this could leave a lot of people in the country who do genuinely need legal help with their exemption matters without anybody to go to, or not anybody.
Okay, Alan, I need you to ask. We don't have a lot of time. Got about 7 minutes. I want you to answer short answers, okay?
Sure.
What exactly are they charging you with to try to take away your license?
Well, this is what is bizarre, Gary. They've actually filed a lawsuit, which you never do. These are administrative proceedings. But they're actually suing me now, asking me to hand over years of client files, and they haven't even said that I've done anything wrong. And that's a legal requirement. You have to have what's called an allegation of misconduct. They're not saying I did anything wrong. What they are saying is they don't like the fact that my website says that I work with clients and attorneys nationally. But they're not saying the website language violates a rule. They're not saying take it down or change it. They're saying we don't like that, so we want to go through all your client files to see if we can find a problem. And that's what
don't cooperate with them.
Oh,
they're on
I'm
a fishing
not,
expedition.
But and that's an actual legal term. It's an
unlawful fishing. Alan, do you want my advice?
Well, I have a detailed plan that I'm implementing and it's in place, but I'm open because this is, you know, there's no manual that tells you how to handle this kind of situation. So go
because I've seen a lot. Because I've seen a lot of people in different fields and they make the mistake of trying to show that they're innocent and comply. You are innocent. Don't comply. The only way you win this is you go aggressive towards them. When you go aggressive towards them, you're going to find the truth. Behind these individuals, there's going to be a larger voice, a different group of people. Might be people from the pharmaceutical industry, might be people who want to stop all exemptions from being filed for vaccines because there's a nationwide 50-state effort by the American Legislative Exchange Council to make all these vaccines mandatory and just keep adding to them. They started in California. It succeeded there. Now they're going nationwide. You're the only obstacle they have. You never, ever win by acknowledging, cooperating with government, ever. Instead, you go after them, and you expose them, and you get these other lawyers who said they had similarly were attacked in their fields without due process or evidence showing they had committed crimes, and you get together, and you sue them in a class action suit. You go to the media. You see, they can have power as long as what they do is quiet. You create a story. You create a story with hard evidence. You take that evidence to honest reporters in the media, and then you get them to investigate. You've given them facts. As long as they can support that your facts are accurate, you've got an advocate. You get one strong advocate in one newspaper exposing them, and that causes this to suddenly stop. That's my suggestion.
And Gary, that's exactly what I'm putting in place right now. I have two petitions, one for attorneys, one for non-attorneys. I'm going through multiple steps that we don't have time to get into right now, but to put a spotlight on this. And the theory, first of all, I can't rely on the system. If this is something the system could fix, it would never have happened to me. It would have been fixed a long time ago. So while the reason they're going with a lawsuit, which they never do in these cases, is because if they get a court order, I'll go to jail. And there's a bar bully on the other side who says, no, Alan, it's not enough for me to suspend your license. I'm going to make you bend to my will. And I'm going to get a court order so that you will have the threat of jail if you don't hand over all your clients' files. But my plan is exactly what you just said, Gary. Put a spotlight on it, because my theory is even a bad person will do the right thing if there's a spotlight on them, a general theory at best, perhaps. But yes, going public. And that's what the website is doing. There's already a story being spread rapidly throughout the alternative health community. You're having me on today is a wonderful opportunity to take that another step further. And I would encourage anyone listening to please go to barwatchonline.org and sign one of those petitions, because when there's a spotlight on this corruption, then it's going to be really hard. As you say, Gary, it's going to be really hard for them to just sort of shove it all under the rug like they've been doing in the past. So thank you for allowing me to come on and contributing to creating that spotlight.
Thank you, Alan, for being there. We'll keep in touch.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm Gary Knoll. We take on the big guys. We take on the corrupt politicians, the system. They're cowards. They're gutless. And we're not afraid of them. Thank you for listening. Have a nice day.